It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, the amazing brain. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around the future of the human brain. Augmented intelligence, memory playback systems, downloadable skill sets. If you think computers are powerful, just wait until science starts hacking the brain.
Can you imagine one day having a brain net where the internet is replaced by a brain net where we send memories, emotions, and feelings on the internet?
Today, we'll get a glimpse of new brain technologies that are already on the drawing board. Of course, the human brain is already one of the most malleable, resilient systems in the universe. For example, Jason Paget has what neurologists call acquired savant syndrome. A traumatic brain injury turned him into a math genius. Every day, in the most ordinary daily activities, running water in the sink, making coffee, he sees mathematically. He describes it in his memoir, Struck by Genius.
Imagine, like, when everything moves, instead of it looking smooth, it looks like individual, like, discrete picture frames coming in. So it's kind of like hitting pause on your TV and watching frame by frame, but in real time. And it's so geometric. It's just absolutely amazing. Or watching water go down the drain, any type of spiral, is instead of looking like it's this smooth spiral like it used to look like, it looks like these little straight tangent lines around the edge, which is like a recursive form of the Pythagorean theorem. It's like taking a squared plus b squared equals c, but then you re-input c as a in the next little triangle, and b, say, for instance, always equals 1, and that creates one type of spiral. And how those numbers vary make it spiral, you know, faster or spiral out longer, you know, that type of thing.
So that's what you see just when you're
constantly
turning on the water in the sink?
Everywhere. Yeah, it's constant. And it never turns off. And it's beautiful.
Jason, you weren't born with the ability to see the world mathematically.
Can you
describe what happened?
Yeah, I was at a little karaoke bar and had some friends there. And I went there and I sang a song. And then I ordered a Coke and then I paid for the Coke. And there was two other guys that were singing karaoke there. And as we left, they left behind us. And I just wasn't paying any attention to them. And they attacked me from behind. I didn't see it coming. I just saw this bright flash of white light and felt this, you know, really deep thud. And the next thing I knew was I was on my knees trying to figure out, why am I on my knees? Where am I? What's going on? Why am I getting hit from all these different directions? And I remember thinking, I'm going to die right now. And that fight or flight kicked in. And then I had this feeling of, I just want to hurt one of these guys before I die. And I grabbed one of their legs and I bit him on the leg so hard that it actually cracked my front teeth and pulled him down on the ground. And then the other guy that was behind me just started hitting me in the back of the head and kicking me in the back of the head and in the back. And they hadn't said anything. And this had been going on for like a minute. And I even looked up at people and said, help. And then I said, gosh, you know, darn it. Only some other words, help. And not one person did anything. One guy just took his hands, like put them up in the air and said, uh-uh, and then turned around and walked away. And so that part was really hard because nobody helped. And then finally one of them said, give me your jacket. And I threw my jacket off, jumped off his friend. They grabbed it and they ran away.
Wow. And at what point in your recovery did you realize that your perception had changed?
It was very, very soon, right afterwards. In fact, there was a hospital right across the street. I went there, and they said, you have, you know, a profound concussion and a bleeding kidney, and they gave me pain medicine, sent me home. And I remember thinking, this pain medicine is just wild stuff because everything looks so weird. But then, you know, the next day, the pain medicine had completely worn off, and then I knew that something for sure was up with me.
Uh-huh.
These other bad things came with it. Like, it was very just traumatic. I didn't realize it was post-traumatic stress, but I mean, I literally holed up in my house for almost 3 years. I would leave basically just to get food. Some other things came with it too, like OCD. Never had OCD. And then suddenly being so aware of everything, it's like constantly being aware of so much coming in that you start noticing, oh, that guy just touched his nose and then he just grabbed a doorknob and now he wants to shake my hand. And you're noticing all this, and when you start noticing that, there's germs everywhere, so it creates this massive amount of anxiety, and it just gets worse and worse. It got so bad that I was, like, Lysoling my money and then putting it in the microwave for 30 seconds to, like, kill the germs on it, washing my hands till they bled, you know, almost. Eventually, I got some treatment for that to make it better. And then I get these uncontrolled muscle movements throughout my body to this day. That they just vibrate, like kind of feels like a cell phone vibrating.
So it's not some weird Cinderella story. You got attacked, you woke up, and hey, you're a genius.
Right,
and
right.
There's some pretty bad parts, too.
Right.
What were you like before the injury?
Before, life was definitely shallow. It did have this kind of blissful ignorance to it, you know, because all I really did was just goof off, chase girls, go out to bars all the time.
You were a party guy.
Total party guy, just goof off, yeah, you know. That's how life went from like 16 to about 31, 32.
Did you like math?
No, I hated it. I was one of those kids that's like, when are you going to use this? And what does this apply to, you know? And I couldn't stand it. Had no interest in it. Really had no interest in school even. I copied a lot off my friends, that type of thing. Skipped
wow.
a lot of classes.
Wow. I mean, you wound up going to school and getting a degree in math. What was it like at first being in a math class? Was it hard to translate for you between what you saw and what the math teacher would say?
Sometimes it was. I had a great teacher. What happened is I was at like a Subway drawing, and I had a guy that was a physicist. He started talking to me and said, "Boy, what you're drawing there looks really mathematical." And he's like, "What are you taking in school?" And I was like, "Oh, I had pre-algebra in high school, and I had was just layman terms to describe it, which is I think the reason why this some people like this is because it's easier for everybody to understand because it's not in these technical terms." And he said, "Well, boy, that's great, but to prove it, you really need to learn how to say things in equations." And he convinced me to go take algebra at just a community college. And I went, and as soon as I got in there, they graphed an equation. And that was when I was like, wait a second, these equations are talking about geometry? Because I didn't even know you could graph an equation. And they were like, my teacher was like, "Yes." And I'm like, "Oh, then we're talking about the same thing. I'm just doing, you know, math in its natural form, which is geometry, and you're doing it in this form, which can prove it."
There's this other gorgeous phrase in the book. You said that you describe this as seeing the mathematical grace of the universe.
Literally. I mean, for instance, like f of the x equals x squared makes a, if you graph that in math, right, it makes a little parabola, like a U shape, you know, opening upwards. And if we do negative x squared, it turns that up. And when you put a negative in front of equation, it takes the shape that it's describing and just flips it upside down, makes a reflection of it. And so when you throw a ball in the air, it makes this little parabolic curve. You know, we use equations to describe the geometry of what's going on in the universe. But what's real, x squared or the parabola? And it's the parabola that's real. And no matter what we're doing in math, we're always describing geometry. And literally, there is nothing that doesn't have geometry. Even empty space, nothing is geometry.
You know, I've heard people say, mathematicians or physicists, that the universe is made of math.
Mm-hmm.
I never really got it until now.
Until you think of it as geometry. And what's so cool is geometry is the one thing that everything has. I always ask teachers, come up with something that doesn't have geometry. And they can't. Even thought is a brainwave. Even empty space is geometry. In fact, it's the one thing that you need nothing to have. Absolutely nothing is geometry, and geometry is equations. So by having nothing, you have every equation in existence. Isn't that crazy? There's
yes.
no beginning. There's no end. It just is. It's
See,
the one thing that is.
Do you feel blissed out?
A lot of times, like we're driving, my daughter will be like, "Dad, it's time to slow down," you know, because I'm looking at this cloud or this tree and just going, "Oh, man, can you see that?" Or wow, you know, or water, especially with light bouncing off of water. Or if there's a rainbow, the rainbows are just awesome because literally that is pie.
Oh. Wow. What do you now think about the human mind because of what's happened to you? I mean, do you think this ability was dormant in you from the beginning and the injury just kind of woke it up?
I think there's a lot of things dormant in us that we don't even realize. Like if somebody throws you a ball and you catch it, you know, you calculated the gravitational field acceleration due to gravity, you know, how long it takes the signal to get from your brain to your fingers to close on the ball. If you were to crunch that as a math equation, it's a serious, you know, equation, yet you just catch the ball. So we're always constantly doing serious math, and our brain just does it naturally.
So that almost makes it sound like maybe your brain slowed down enough to be able to see
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's more going on around us by far that we can't see or perceive in any way than what we really do see. I mean, like, there's a trillion neutrinos shooting every square centimeter of us every second. And I mean, if you could see all the stuff going on, it would just look like a jumbled mess. So it's almost like our bodies have evolved to filter out all of these other things so that we can actually get something done.
Right. You know? I was going to say, it must be hard. I mean, it sounds a little overwhelming
to
be aware of it all the time.
It is. It would. There are times when I wish I could just turn it off because I want to just sleep or I just want to relax.
I'm curious, if somebody came to you, if I came to you and said, some neurologists have figured out what to change in my brain so that I could see the world the way you do, would you suggest I go for it? Or would you say,
And have all the drawbacks? Even then, I would have to say, you know what? If you're willing for the drawbacks, if you're willing to take it, I wouldn't give it up. There's no way I would give it up. Absolutely not. Even though it's sometimes really annoying and these bad things have come with it, the good far outweighs the bad. Mm-hmm. So I would not give it up, and I would tell everybody else, go for it as long as you're willing to put up with the rest.
Thank you so much for talking. It was a pleasure.
You too. Thank you very much.
Jason Padgett's memoir is called Struck by Genius. So what if you didn't have to get hit on the head to become a genius? What if you could take a pill or download some netware that would supercharge your brain? Hollywood loves that story, but so do a few real scientists. Theoretical physicist Michio Kaku has just written a book called The Future of the Mind. He told Steve Paulson we're in a golden age of brain science.
Think 10, 15 years ago when the brain was largely a black box. Now, however, using MRI scans, we can see down to about a tenth of a millimeter. We can actually see thoughts ricocheting like a ping-pong ball inside the brain. And so we've learned more about the brain in the last 10 years than in all of human history combined.
Now, one of the hottest fields in neuroscience is the brain-machine interface. What's happening here?
Oh, there's been an absolute explosion of this. For example, Stephen Hawking, my colleague, the famous cosmologist, has lost complete control of his fingers, so we physicists put a chip in his right glass, an antenna that connects him to a laptop computer, allowing him to communicate with the outside world. And if you put a chip directly on top of the brain, you can now control a laptop computer, which controls a wheelchair, household appliances, allows you to write email, send email, do crossword puzzles, play video games, operate the light switch. Anything you can do with a computer, these people can do with the mind.
You'll have to explain this. So going back to the example of Stephen Hawking, so he has this this chip in the corner of his glasses. How does he actually use that to activate a computer?
Well, what happens is, commercially now, headbands are available. You don't have to put a chip in your glass, but headbands are available that pick up radio from the brain. The brain is a milliwatt transmitter. It's electrical. It emits a slight amount of electromagnetic radiation, which can be picked up by these headbands and by these chips. Then they're connected to a computer. And historically, we never knew how to unravel this mass of data coming from these sensors, but now we can. We can create a dictionary between certain impulses picked up by the headband and certain motions of the cursor on a computer screen.
Well, speaking of kind of these science fiction-like technologies, you talk about the possibility of new technology that will record our memories.
Yes, this was once considered totally preposterous. I mean, how can you record a memory after all? It's so fleeting. But at Wake Forest University in North Carolina and also in Los Angeles, they did it. You take a mouse and you put electrodes on the hippocampus, which is the gateway to memory. By recording the messages, they can then replay these messages months later, and you remember tasks that you had forgotten. So they trained the mouse to sip water. They recorded the memory on the hippocampus, replayed the memory months later, and bingo, the mouse remembered on the first try.
How do you record a memory?
Well, you record a memory very simply by tape recording the impulses going from the left to the right part of the hippocampus. We have no way of decoding this. In other words, we're actually clueless as to how to decipher this tape recording, but you don't have to know. And next will come primate trials. For example, a monkey may eat a banana or something like that. And after that, the short-term goal is to create a brain pacemaker, such that you push a button and you immediately know where you live, who you are, for Alzheimer's patients. Think of it. There are going to be tens of millions of people around the world with Alzheimer's wandering our streets, not knowing where they live, who they are. They'll be able to push a button and retrieve many of these memories. And beyond that, perhaps even complex memories can be encoded, meaning that perhaps workers will be able to learn high-tech skills rather than having to go back to college to retrain themselves after they've been fired from their old job, which has been replaced by technology.
Well, it raises a question of what kinds of memories you would be able to record. I mean, is it sort of information, for instance, where you live, or can you actually record more personal kinds of memories going back to childhood?
Well, here's an example of recording a vacation that you never had. Let's say that a test subject takes a vacation and has a luxurious walk on this beautiful, shiny beach. You can record that memory, that little snippet of memory of being right in the middle of this tremendous white beach and seeing the ocean, tape record that memory, record it on tape, and then play it back into someone else's hippocampus, and they too will have a memory of walking on the beach.
But I have to say, some of what you've been describing makes me a little nervous. I mean, the idea, for instance, of uploading memories into someone else's brain, I mean, memory that they never had, this really is right out of science fiction in a dystopian kind of way, I would think.
Well, it opens up a tremendous avenue of research, also entertainment. Can you imagine one day having a brain net where the internet is replaced by a brain net where we send memories, emotions, and feelings on the internet? Children would love it. Can you imagine Facebook? It would explode with memories of the first date, the first kiss, the first senior prom, things like that. But as you correctly pointed out, technology is a sword. It can be used to cut against ignorance, poverty, and disease, but it can also be used to cut against people. For example, at MIT just last year, they were able to upload the first false memory. False memories have now been uploaded into the brains of mice. And it means that in the future, perhaps the memory of a crime that you never committed could be uploaded into someone. And so this would probably have to be regulated. That is, memories in the future, I imagine, would have to be stated that clearly that this is a false memory. It's a memory of something that never happened. And you would have to have that information uploaded when the memory itself is uploaded.
Well, it also places tremendous power in the hands of the computer programmers. I mean, the people who are actually controlling this technology. Does this alarm you at all, some of these developments?
Well, first of all, we are genetically hardwired to be apprehensive about the future because our ancestors were timid apes. And so it's natural for us when we first hear about the internet, when we first hear about these technologies that are going to revolutionize our world, we're a little bit apprehensive. But then later, hey, we just get used to it.
Michio Kaku is a theoretical physicist at the City University of New York. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, The Future of the Mind. Coming up, the story of a world-class composer who lost the ability to write music and then learned how all over again. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If you've been following To the Best of Our Knowledge the last few months, you know we're collaborating with Sipur Israeli, or Israel Story, the This American Life of Israel. It's one of the most popular radio shows in that country. In today's episode, Shai Satran brings us the story of an Israeli composer who lost her music after a traumatic brain injury and through hard work, got it back.
Hello, Shai.
Hi, Noah.
I met Noah Gai
an Israeli composer, in her Manhattan apartment.
Well, when people ask me how did you end up in New York, I always say by accident.
We'll get back to how and why Noa ended up in New York. But her story starts in her hometown, Jerusalem.
I was born in Jerusalem and grew up there. And from very, very early age was attracted to music and studied music.
The fact that Noa was so drawn to music was kind of surprising.
It's hard to say how Noa becomes so much into it.
This is Avnel, Noa's brother.
Our parents did not expose us to classical music.
Our father was injured in the Independence War and had always had headaches, so the house has to be quiet.
And a loud noise would disturb him a lot. And many times he would leave home just when Noa was playing, which was not very much encouraging. And in spite of that, she was very stubborn and continued to practice, to learn more.
So music was, in a way, sort of a noise. But nevertheless, I continued, and that was my passion. After high school, no question what I'm going to do. I went to the Jerusalem Music Academy, finished the theory department, and then studied composition privately, and then moved to Berlin to study music there.
After winning many international prizes, Noa moved back to Israel and was appointed to be the manager of the Jerusalem Music Academy, which, as you can imagine, is quite a big deal. And all in all, her career was booming.
And on 93, I came to work with Isaac Stern for a week.
Noa's week in New York was supposed to culminate with a concert at Carnegie Hall, a high point of any composer's career. The first few days of the week leading up to that concert were set aside for final rehearsals.
On that day, which was a Thursday, we went to his country house in Connecticut to work there in, you know, a different environment and quiet environment. I don't remember really much since. It was a country road. It was in the fall. Trees were burning colors, beautiful colors. Everything was a little like a dream in a way. I do remember the last thing that I told Isaac, that I think that he's driving very, very fast. And he looked at me, you know, side look, and he used to call me Bubele. So I said, Bubele, don't worry, I'm a very good driver. That's the last thing I remember.
And on the way, he hit a tree and created a very severe injury to my sister. She just got out of the car, pulled him out, and then collapsed. She was evacuated to a New York hospital over there and was in a coma for quite a few days. And that came in a time that she was really getting into the peak of her career.
She woke up 8 days later.
The first thing that I remember is that I was violated, that something really awful happened. I didn't know where I was, I didn't know where I was alive or where I was dead. I was just seeing these half-white creatures hovering over me, touching me as if, you know, without asking permission. And it was an awful way to wake up. I couldn't make sense of anything. It's really tempting to give up at a situation like that. But it was a decision not to. I'm going to make it.
But she made two decisions. One, to stay in life. Second one was that she'll be okay and she'll be able to function as a normal person.
That second decision, to lead a normal life, would require tremendous efforts and many years.
I was paralyzed on the whole right side of the body. You know, I had shoulder injury, hip injury, all kinds of injuries, but the main thing was the brain injury.
She was then with one of the physicians. They just put a pencil in front of her and asked her, what is that? And she could not say the word. She could not identify. And then I burst in tears, and it was the first time for her to see me really crying.
It's not easy to explain, because after I got a little better and I was able to communicate and I began to live again, people didn't realize what really was going on. That for me to hear a sentence and remember the whole sentence and formulate an answer, was an enormous task, and that's why I call this a transparent injury, because from the outside I looked fine. I was talking, I was nice, I was smiling, I was polite. And inside it was this struggle to go on, not to let the injury shut me down, and because it was so taxing.
When we talk to each other now and there's some background noise, we can ignore this noise. But she cannot. She has to process it through her mind and decide what she had constructed it. And that takes a lot of energy and very tiring.
What Avner just described is a malfunction of sorts of Noah's attention modification system. It can be explained through a famous psychological finding, the cocktail party effect. Imagine you're chatting with someone at a cocktail party. There are many different background noises. Loud music is playing, the sounds of silverware, plates, glasses clinking, not to mention all the other conversations taking place all around. But somehow, we sort of lower the volume on all those background sounds and raise it on our friend's voice. We don't have to think about it. We're not even conscious of it. It just happens. Basically, our brain is constantly filtering out a huge amount of stimuli that simply isn't that important to us. Without these filters, our brain would overload.
What does it feel like to sit in a noisy restaurant and just have a conversation with a friend?
About half an hour after it begins, I have to leave because it's just bombarding me in a way that I'm so overwhelmed that at a certain point it's too much. You know, when you talk to me, you listen to me and you're not listening to the environment. And for me, all the sounds are at the same level. It's almost impossible to explain. It's as if I'm on a stage and there's floodlights all the time. There is nothing more important than the others. I can't filter out things because I lost the filters that we usually have of discerning what's important and what not. It's exhausting.
This condition of not being able to perceive or focus on more than a single object at a time has a name: simultagnosia. It's pretty rare, and most of the people who suffer from it, like Noah, experienced some sort of traumatic brain injury. But Noah's case is particularly interesting to researchers because her entire musical perception changed after the accident.
The first piece I wanted to listen to was Beethoven's String Quartet. And the first time I listened to it, I was blown away because I didn't hear a string quartet. I just heard four laser beams of sounds. They were very clear and totally disconnected. I couldn't make sense of it. I couldn't put it together. And I heard the violin, cello, viola, and I didn't know what it was. It was like four parallel independent lines that wouldn't connect. They were totally independent. It was like a piece of puzzle, you know, just scattered on the table. And you know that if you put them in the right pattern, they fit. I couldn't do that. I heard it, I don't know how many times. I heard it again and again in the hope that I will be able to put them together. Couldn't put it together.
Oliver Sacks, the famous neurologist, dedicated a chapter to Noah in his 2007 book, Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain. Sacks gave Noah's condition a name, disharmonia, the inability to integrate auditory components into a single harmony. Noah, of course, had devoted her life to music, and this was the worst injury she could imagine.
In a way, I think that if I would have lost a leg, it would have been easier for me. But the fact that I lost a major part of my identity, of my inner identity, and that I could not recreate it, is cruel and painful still today. At a certain point, you know, listening to it again and again, it became like a torture.
Despite her disharmonia, Noah discovered that with substantial efforts, she could still appreciate and even create music. For example, when Noah reads sheet music, she can, in a sense, still imagine the music, at least in her mind, even though she can't hear the music. It's confusing. Her road to recovery was long and full of hurdles.
Today I can put things together, but it's work. I have to do it consciously. It's not that I put a piece of music and I hear the music. No, now I'm hearing the string quartet, so listen to them together. And I learned how to do that, but it's still a conscious process. It used to be like language. I wrote string quartets. I mean, it wasn't even a question. It was a pleasure, and it was my refuge.
Noa had to relearn even the most basic skills.
I bought a piano, and I couldn't play. And it was a shock. After trying and realizing that I'm not going to be able to do it alone, I swallowed my pride and started taking piano lessons. I had to learn the ear-eye-hand coordination. It was a sort of a gift because I realized how complicated piano playing is, but it was also very frustrating because I lost my ability to play. I lost this connection to music that I had, that I could sit and write music like you write a letter. And it was so easy and everything was so enjoyable and so fluent. And I think that's the major thing, that if you ask me if something didn't heal, this didn't heal. Everything else is fine.
Noa was stubborn. She learned to play the piano again and eventually even went back to composing. In 2006, 13 years after that concert that should have been, Noa finally got her New York City debut.
I made 3 big pieces, hour long each. Actually, it's a musical diary of my recovery. So the first piece is from darkness to waking up, just broken pieces that are somehow put together and in the end are making some sort of sense. And a friend of mine came afterwards and she said, I know you for so many years. It's the first time that I begin to understand what you're going through.
At the beginning of the piece, you remember, Noa explained that she ended up in New York by accident, quite literally. What she didn't say is that she hasn't been back to Israel since that accident, over 20 years ago.
Since then, she cannot travel because all of her balance organs were destroyed, so she's stuck for life in New York City, which is not bad. There are worse places to be stuck at.
For a very long time, I thought that, well, another 6 months of therapy and I'll be back home. I always wanted to go home.
She didn't make it back home. She didn't see my father because he was sick and couldn't travel, and she couldn't travel, and he passed away quite a few years ago. She could not be at her daughter's wedding and things like that.
And it took many years of therapy and forgiving and accepting to realize, okay, I can't go back. Israel is still, you know, I'm Israeli, but it's not painful anymore. But it used to be a real longing to come home. It took a lot of work to realize that a new beginning is the right approach and not hanging on to the past, which is not available. I'm in a place that I don't think that I would have been here in this form, being able to look at things and see things and see the world in a way that I do. And in a topsy-turvy way, I'm grateful for it.
Our story comes from Shai Satram with Israel Story. You can listen to more Israel Story pieces on our website at ttbook.org. And if you like them, tune in to Israel Story's first season in English on the Vox Tablet podcast. And that wraps up our conversation about music, math, and the brain. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk football and why some fans are giving it up. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
My name is Albert Nuremberg. I'm a filmmaker, director of boredom, stupidity, and laughology. I also work as a hypnotist, and my dangerous idea is that I believe that all drugs, the effects of drugs and alcohol as well, are entirely in the mind. We believe that we need drugs and alcohol to get high, and I got the idea recently working actually at a drug rehab where I was dealing with people who had major addictions, and I became fascinated by wondering in what ways they are different, let's say, than the rest of us. And one of the ways that the younger ones tend to be different is they believe the only way you can get high in life is through drugs or alcohol. It's just the only way. And they see the natural highs, either they're unaware of them, let's say a natural high like skydiving or going down a waterfall or something like that, they see that as not having the same effect or not being as fun. And so I became struck by the idea that there's a well-known hypnotist's parlor trick where you can hypnotize people to be drunk. And if you interview the people that were hypnotized afterwards, they will describe the effects as being absolutely real, that they felt drunk, tipsy, giddy, happy, all the things, and that they behave quite accurately like somebody is drunk. And I thought, wait a second, maybe you could extrapolate this idea into every kind of drug high. And so what I have done, and my dangerous idea, is that you can take groups of people, and if you hypnotize them, they have to be in what's called a deep somnambulant state, you can then put them into any drug state, including cocaine, heroin, alcohol, ecstasy, LSD, mushrooms, and you can even mix them up so they could be 50% cocaine, 50% heroin, that they can experience all the effects. Their pupils dilate, their hearts beat, they sweat, they stumble around, they hallucinate. And then within seconds, you can remove the effects entirely without side effects. You can even invent drugs that don't exist. I often ask the audience, give me a set of possible drug effects, and then we put people on that drug. The last one we did was Ludicron, which is a drug that makes you feel high. If anybody says something serious, you will laugh. When you look at the audience, you will believe that they are entirely naked. And I found this was true. That's what happened to the people that were on this drug. They screamed when they saw the audience, and they laughed whenever somebody spoke. So my dangerous idea is that drugs and alcohol are killing more people via overdose than at any other time in human history. This is not me that's saying this. It's the CDC that said it. And that wouldn't it be shocking and dangerous to know that this whole business is entirely in your mind?
A dangerous idea from filmmaker and hypnotist Albert Nuremberg. You'll find more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. The NFL season kicks off this weekend, so we're thinking football. America's most popular and lucrative sport has pretty much eclipsed baseball as our national pastime, or maybe we should say obsession. Our studios are in Green Bay Packer territory, a place where football is practically a religion. But football fandom doesn't sit pretty with everyone these days. Writer and lifelong NFL fan Steve Almond has done some serious soul-searching about it. He asked himself, why am I obsessed with an inherently violent, racist, and homophobic sport? Why do I love something that's so obviously wrong? Almond unpacks these questions in his book Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Charles Monroe Kane sat down with him to talk some football.
What happened? I mean, was there one event that changed your mind that turned you against the sport you love?
Well, a couple of things. One, I still love football, and, you know, I have tremors when I have to not watch it. So it's not like I suddenly decided, oh, football is brutal and terrible and savage. And it's more like I realized, oh, my God, this game is really amazing. And it's got a real grip on my heart, my soul, my wallet. But it's also all these other things. And the thing that really started it, I think actually the thing that started it was I'd been seeing the news reports. Everybody's been seeing the news reports about the links between playing football and the developing brain damage. And that was something that I, you know, out of one corner of my eye had been watching at the same time as sneaking off to the bar to watch the game with my neighbor so we don't go crazy. So last summer, I got a call from my brother telling me that something was very wrong with my mom. And I had to fly out to see her. She was in intensive care. What had happened was that my mom had gone into a delirium in which she had almost no cognitive function. It was very abrupt, very frightening. And when I came into the hospital expecting to see my mom, I did, but she was not there. She didn't know where she was. She didn't always recognize me. And there were little painful bursts of lucidity where she knew that something was terribly wrong. She described it to me as an awful dream. And that was the fact that she didn't have much brain function. So I was really face to face with something that I had not even really conceived of before, which is what it's like when somebody you love who's important to you has lost their mind. And, you know, they talk about, oh, well, you know, the self resides in our soul and in our heart. And it's nonsense, man. It's in your brain. That's what makes you who you are. And when your brain is gone, you are gone. And it's absolutely heartbreaking to see up front. And I think seeing her, Charles, really sort of connected the two synapses in my head. The one that was like, I just want to see the game. It's an amazing game. It's so stirring, exciting. It's so dramatically satisfying, et cetera. And the other synapse that says, hey, there's something really rotten in the state of Denmark. This game is bad for people, you know, the tug at your conscience. When I started to look into football more deeply, it got much, much darker.
But you're a lifelong fan. You're a Raider fan, right?
You just have to bring it up, and it's painful. But yes, I am an Oakland Raider. You know what? It's like an alcoholic. I'm going to stand up and say, my name is Steve Allman. I'm an Oakland Raider fan.
Well, I just for disclosure here, for people listening, I'm the guy doing the interview. I am a major football fan. I love football. I played football in high school. I live in Wisconsin. I'm a Green Bay Packer fan, tried and true. I'm the kind of guy that, like, grows a mohawk and paints it green. I paint my face, take my shirt off at below zero up there at Lambeau.
Wow.
And if you go to the Northwoods of Wisconsin, it is like a religion up there. I love
oh
the NFL.
God.
What about you? Why do you love it? What do you love about it?
Well,
football?
I'll tell you. So the reason that I think football is so remarkable is because there is no single game I know of that so clearly connects us to the intuitive physical pleasures of being a kid. Running, jumping, leaping, tackling, throwing, catching. And it's very elemental. It isn't as regimented as baseball. There's no esoteric equipment like hockey. It really is, take away everything, you know, all the uniforms and all the playbook and everything, it boils down to these very intuitive pleasures that you see on display and that we recognize intuitively. You know, I watched, like, John Elway when I was, I sold hot dogs at the Stanford games and when he was in, you know, quarterback at Stanford, and Stanford wasn't very good. But just watching him, every game, you are going to see something miraculous. You are going to see his body intuitively discover in the midst of a complete ruined play some miraculous possibility, and his body was going to make that miracle happen. That is why we go to sports, and football does it more purely than any other sport. It is the most strategically dense sport and also the most primally gratifying. You get sort of brains and brawn all in the same package.
But Steve, your book is called Against Football.
I'm going to go ahead and say it's the best thing since sliced bread, but the sliced bread is not good for you. The sliced bread actually corrodes your soul. And so it tastes delicious, and you should definitely butter it and maybe face paint it or whatever, but it also is connected to all these negative things. So I happen to think that football is a huge industry, that football is a profoundly violent game, and that I believe football really desensitizes us, gives us a greater tolerance for violence, a greater tolerance, I think, for racism, for militarism, and is in the sport itself and the way that it's been commercialized, the way in which they take those great exalted emotions that we were just expressing and they basically treat those as a cash register, the nihilistic greed of the sport is insane and out of control. And the ultimate lesson or the ultimate point of my book is we, you and me, Oakland Raiders face paint guy and, you know, green and yellow mohawk guy are the ones who give them that power. We, the fans, have made the football industrial complex. That's on us.
Well, let's break it down a little bit. Football is violent, right? Hitting each other is part of the game. And not just hitting each other, these big, huge muscle men, supermen of the NFL, hitting each other, people are going to get hurt. Do you think that violence is a necessary evil in the NFL, or is it intrinsic?
I think it's an evil in the NFL, and I think it's probably necessary for certain fans to enjoy the game. I mean, look, tomorrow, say you're Roger Goodell, okay? We've got like $30 million just lying around our apartment. We're like lighting cigars with $1,000 bills. You know, that's us. We're Roger Goodell, okay? we have this sport that's inherently violent. There are all these collisions. They're built into it. Mass times force equals velocity. I think I remember that from high school. The players are bigger and faster than ever, and so they're going to be getting into all these collisions because that's the nature of the game. There are going to be all these big catastrophic injuries, you know, concussions, you know, Jackson yeah. Jaguar player who suffered a stroke during the game after a hit. But there's also, more dangerously and invisibly, all these small sub-concussive hits, right, that are not quite a concussion. They're like a small car accident inside your helmet. And that's causing brain damage. It can cause brain damage. And we're seeing some of our most famous players, Junior Seau, certainly Tony Dorsett, Terry Bradshaw, all of these Hall of Famers who are either, you know, Junior Seau right. took his life, and those two, Bradshaw and Dorsett, have talked openly about how they're struggling with cognitive function. They're brain damaged. So if you're Roger Goodell, you have to realize, wait a second, I want this game to be profitable. That's my job. But there's also this violence, and I'm having to pay out billions of dollars. Probably the settlement for the huge concussion lawsuit is going to amount to billions of dollars. Why not just take the violence out of the game? Why not remove that component if it's really about grace and athleticism and strategy and so forth? The reason they don't is because we, the fans, again, it's on us, dude. We, the fans, want the game to be violent. We want it to be graceful, exciting, dramatically satisfying. But part of that satisfaction comes from the fact that players are at risk, and we really get off on it. And the TV networks know this. They replay those injuries, those big hits, over and over. Yeah. They're the ones who are holding those parabolic mics on the sidelines so you can hear the sound of impact. They're now miking up players actually on their shoulder pads or, you know, inside their uniforms so that we can hear the bone-crunching, bone-rattling hits. That is us. We make those decisions. And we can make the decision at a certain point, if we really consult with our conscience and really look at why we're drawn to the game, we could say, you know what, I'm turning away from the game until it either tones down or eliminates the violent part of the equation. But there are enough fans who really, that's what they turn to the game about. And my book is essentially saying, okay, own it, dude. You know what I mean? Don't say yeah. that you really love.
Be honest. You liked exactly. that hit. His arms are outstretched, and that cornerback came in.
Bingo.
You liked it. The Green Bay Packers are opening the NFL against the Seattle Seahawks, which, when this airs, would have been a couple days earlier. How many players are we yeah. going to lose to injury in that game? Because Seattle's known in their secondary yeah. for injuring people.
That is your job as a defensive football player, is to be intimidating and to null out your empathy, to just dull it out and get rid of it. Your job is to be a predator, to hurt somebody, to play lights out football, to make them know you've been there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are all these euphemisms that coaches and players and broadcasters and pundits use to describe the process of somebody no longer feeling concern about the moral implications of a violent act that they're about to commit. And I know that it's within the context of football, but it's still knocking somebody out. You know, when I was a kid, I saw Jack Tatum on a play in a preseason game. Charles, you probably remember this. It was in like 1978. And Daryl Stingley yeah. was a wide receiver for the New England Patriots, their best wide receiver. And Jack Tatum was the most feared cornerback in the league. And on a play where Daryl Stingley could not even get to the ball, it was that far out of reach, he lunged for it. Jack Tatum put a hit on him. Stingley tried to duck his head real quickly, and he fell to the ground in a heap and was paralyzed. And it was quite clear from the way that his body had fallen on the ground, if you look at it, that he was in terrible shape and that something was fundamentally wrong with him. Jack Tatum did not for one moment say, oh my God, that was a really tough hit. Are you okay, fellow human being? He strutted away. The other Oakland Raiders strutted right. away. And I, as an 11-year-old kid, or however old it was, maybe 7 years old, I didn't say, wow, a human being might have just gotten seriously injured, and I watched it as a form of entertainment. What's going on inside my conscience? Why am I being turned into a person who views that as entertainment? I didn't do that. And I, you know, it's taken me 40 years to really take stock of that, because the mentality of football is really, in a certain way, it's like capitalism and shoulder pads and steroids. And that our need specifically for violence and aggression is a central pillar of why that industry is so powerful.
You know, I hate to ask you this, but I think it's important. Do you miss the Raiders? Do you miss watching football?
I will not be watching the you know, the games this year, but that doesn't mean I won't want to be. And it's really a different thing. Like, the path I'm recommending is that people read the book and think about the role that football plays in their lives and think about the subtle, insidious aspects of the game, as well as just the outright nihilistic greed, the damage I think the game does to, you know, the way that we perceive women, the way that we perceive, you know, men of color, the way that we perceive economic justice in the world. Like, I think there's a lot of stuff that's just quite clearly bad for America that football represents and fosters. So that's one thing. But again, that's superego stuff. There's another part of me that says, yeah, but the game is remarkable and beautiful, and I get a lot of pleasure out of it. And it's not going to be easy for me to sit there and just say, okay, well, now I'm done with that because it's so dumb and I'm not interested in it anymore and I'm above it. If I didn't care about football at all, I don't think I would have written a whole book about it. I care passionately about it. I'm not trying to rescue it. I'm not trying to save it. I'm trying to see it for what it is and get other fans who feel like I do, who have the same crazy, to start to think about what it means in their lives.
Steve Almond, talking with Charles Monroe Kane. The book is Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. And that's it for today's show. If you have comments or questions about football or anything else you heard, let us know. You can reach us on our website at ttbook.org or on our Facebook page. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced in the heart of Packerland at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson with help from Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, and Will Henkes. Our theme music was composed by Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. And we welcome a new staff member, Craig Ely, who comes to us on a public humanities fellowship courtesy of the American Council of Learned Societies. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for joining us.
PRI, Public Radio International.